From national news in D.C.
to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol,
this is your Capitol Connection.
And now, bringing the Capitol to you,
here's your host, Nate Groz.
Election controversy, uncertainty, and division. Where do we go from here? We'll offer post-election thoughts and analysis, including why a Biden-Harris administration would be the most pro-abortion in history. Plus, why the truth about the Pilgrims and the Mayflower Compact is as important for our country as ever. We'll get to all this and more on this week's Capitol Connection. As always, we are broadcasting from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studio in Lincoln with a lot to get to on today's show. And so I want to start with a question that is being asked widely in conservative circles. Would a Biden-Harris presidential administration be the most pro-abortion administration in history? And sadly, I think the answer is clearly yes. We already know, for example, that a Biden administration, they are planning already to reverse numerous pro-life policies instituted under the Trump administration through executive orders beginning on day one. According to the Christian Post, former Vice President Joe Biden has vowed to roll back a number of President Trump's executive orders and dismantle the administration's pro-life policies. While we're still waiting for all of this to unfold, the Biden team have already unveiled a Biden administration agenda, which includes a section on early executive actions. And Vice President Biden's agenda includes reversing Trump administration's pro-life initiatives. According to the document, Biden would reverse, quote, Trump actions on abortion and reproductive health care, including reversing the Mexico City policy, restoring funding to Planned Parenthood and contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The Mexico City policy was first signed into law by President Ronald Reagan, and it requires foreign non-governmental organizations to promise not to perform or actively promote abortion as a method of family planning using U.S. taxpayer dollars. So by pledging to reverse that, that means that U.S. taxpayer dollars will now be going towards actively promoting and performing abortions overseas. And it's really hard to imagine a worse use of American taxpayer dollars than taking those funds from U.S. citizens and using them, those taxpayer dollars, to perform and promote abortion in other countries. But this pledge to reverse the Mexico City policy is consistent with the actions of previous Democrat presidents. For example, President Bill Clinton rescinded the Mexico City policy upon taking office in 1993. His successor, President George W. Bush, reinstated that policy. And then, of course, former President Barack Obama, when he took office, rescinded the Mexico City policy again during his first term. And when President Trump took office, he reinstated that policy as one of his earliest actions as president. And actually, it was earlier this year that the Trump administration proposed expanding the Mexico City policy to apply to all contracts and subcontracts that provide global health funding. But it's not just the Mexico City policy, which is an important one. In 2019, the Trump administration implemented what is known as a Protect Life Rule, which bars health facilities that receive Title X family planning funds from performing, promoting, or referring to abortion as a method of family planning. And rather than comply with that rule, Planned Parenthood, the largest abortion business in the country, chose to withdraw from the Title X program. And so Planned Parenthood, again, the number one abortion provider, couldn't receive those taxpayer funds through the Title X program. But now Joe Biden has vowed to restore funding to Planned Parenthood and do away with the newly implemented Protect Life rule. And of course, sadly, it doesn't end there either. The Biden team also is looking at restoring the contraceptive mandate under the Affordable Care Act, which could result in religious employers being forced to pay for birth control coverage and abortifacients in their employees' health insurance plans in an obvious and clear violation of their religious beliefs. Marjorie Dansfeller, the president of the pro-life Susan B. Anthony list in Washington, D.C., had previously warned that Biden and Harris would begin immediately rolling back President Trump's pro-life gains. According to Danceveller, quote, Biden and Harris constitute the most pro-abortion presidential ticket in American history. And Senator Harris, of course, voted against the pro-life Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act very recently in the United States Senate. And that law was debated and voted on in the U.S. Senate. It had a majority support, but not enough to overcome a filibuster from Democrats. And Senator Harris voted no on that bill, which was simply seeking to ensure that children who survive abortion and are born alive aren't just left to die, and that they receive immediate and appropriate medical care just like any other human being would receive. And she voted against that. Joe Biden has also expressed a desire to codify Roe v. Wade. So the idea there behind codifying Roe v. Wade into law would be that abortion would be the law of the land, not because the Supreme Court said so, so that even if the Supreme Court reverses or overturns or alters the precedent under Roe v. Wade, there would be a federal law in place codifying Roe with the goal of preventing states from passing further pro-life restrictions on abortion. And of course, Joe Biden, he also decided to switch his position on the Hyde Amendment, which prevents the use of taxpayer dollars to fund abortions. He previously supported that amendment, which has long held bipartisan support to prevent taxpayer dollars from funding abortions. And during the campaign, he flipped his position to oppose it and supports doing away with it again to provide more taxpayer funding for abortion. Another major concern is that now we're going beyond just issuing executive orders or rescinding previous executive orders or trying to direct funds toward abortion and abortion providers. The Biden team, according to their own campaign website, they also want to attempt to eliminate many of the nation's pro-life laws that help to protect women and preborn babies. The website states that a Biden administration will not only, quote, reverse the Trump administration, but they will also reverse states' all-out assault on women's right to choose, which is just a euphemism for taking the life of an innocent human being in the womb. Quote, as president, Biden will work to codify Roe v. Wade, and his Justice Department will do everything in its power to stop the rash of state laws that so blatantly violate the constitutional right to an abortion, such as so-called trap laws, parental notification requirements, mandatory waiting periods, and ultrasound requirements. They are flat out telling us that they want to do away with some of the most important and basic pro-life protections that have been passed by states with overwhelming support. Things like, again, parental notification requirements. So taking that away means that minors, young children, could go receive abortion and their parents would never have to be notified. Doing away with mandatory waiting periods and ultrasound requirements so that women don't even have the option. They wouldn't even have the ability to see an ultrasound and to have the opportunity to see that life inside the womb growing and living and moving. And that would be absolutely devastating. To codify abortion would mean to include it in the United States Constitution as a statutory right, which certainly is by no means the intent of what is in our Constitution. All of this means that for supporters of life, those who are advocating and fighting for the right to life and care deeply about the sanctity of life and protecting preborn children in the womb and ensuring that every single human being is treated with dignity and respect and given the chance to live, the next 4 years, potentially, they will not be smooth sailing. But we also need to remember that history has shown that during such times, states take it upon themselves, Republican-led states in particular, take initiative and create pro-life legislation to help thwart a pro-abortion agenda wherever possible and work to pass more pro-life laws which help save lives. And that's what we have to keep working to do. we have to stay on guard and we have to be ready to go, because this isn't limited to just the issue of abortion either. Last week, the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest LGBT activist group, sent a post-election list of demands, and they wield a lot of influence within the Biden team, and they sent this list of demands to Vice President Joe Biden, declaring that a number of policy proposals that they are asking and demanding that they would seek to implement through this, what they are calling their blueprint for positive change. And they lay out a roadmap of 85 individual policy recommendations that they want to see implemented. Included in their agenda is requiring Christian schools to hire LGBT-identified individuals or face discrimination charges and lose accreditation. They also want to force faith-based adoption and foster care agencies who believe children should have a mom and a dad to place children with same-sex couples. They lay out policy proposals for almost every government and department. And Dr. Albert Mohler, the head of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminar, wrote a really important piece in response to this. And he lays out how this list of demands is a huge threat to religious freedom. And he especially makes note of the policy proposals that are laid out specifically to the Department of Education. He writes that the Human Rights Campaign demands the Biden administration to ensure that non-discrimination policies and science-based curriculum are not undermined by religious exemption to accreditation standards. He writes that that is sinister. I've not seen any document like this before. The Human Rights Campaign is effectively calling for religious colleges and schools to be coerced into the sexual revolution or stripped of accreditation. We must not miss the language. Accreditation should be revoked for those who do not meet the LGBT non-discrimination standards or science-based curriculum standards. What this means in very simple terms is that Christian schools, faith-based schools, would no longer be allowed to exist unless they get on board with the Human Rights Campaign's agenda and the LGBT agenda. And if you can't question it, if you don't comply, if you don't agree, then we're no longer going to allow you to be able to operate in the public square. We will strip accreditation from your Christian schools. We will shut down Christian adoption agencies. And even though you treat everyone equally and you don't discriminate, but just because you believe what the Bible teaches about marriage and human sexuality, we will force you out and we will punish you because of your beliefs. That is what they have laid out on the table and demanded of a Biden administration, who they are very much aligned with. The Human Rights Campaign is also demanding that they, quote, eliminate discrimination against beneficiaries in charitable choice and faith-based initiatives. In other words, force Christian homeless and domestic violence shelters to place men who claim to be women in all-female facilities. And this has happened. It's happened multiple times in different places across the country where these pro-LGBT laws have been implemented and used against faith-based homeless shelters and domestic violence shelters, women's shelters. And they require women who have been traumatized to be placed right next to biological men. The list also includes, finally, a demand to, quote, rescind and replace regulations restricting coverage of Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, which would force doctors and hospitals to perform abortions and transgender surgeries. Make no mistake, this is an all-out assault on religious freedom, and it's not even being hidden anymore. It's in plain view for all to see. So where do we go from here? What do we do with this? We need to remember that ultimately our salvation is not found in human beings or in any administration. It's found through Christ and through Him alone. The gospel is the key. But how do we go about our daily lives, and how do we share the gospel and live our lives faithfully according to our beliefs in a culture and in a government system that is going to be increasingly hostile towards what people of faith believe? We need to stand for truth, And we need to stand for truth, knowing that many times it might come at a cost. But we can stand for the truth and advocate for what is right and what is good and what contributes most to human flourishing. And we can do it out of love for our neighbor. And we can do so winsomely and with grace and bear witness to the truth in how we live our day-to-day lives. Nebraska Family Alliance is the state-based affiliate of Focus on the Family. And recently, Focus on the Family President Jim Daly offered some important post-election thoughts and reflections that we would like to share today. This is Focus on the Family President Jim Daly on how we can move forward amidst so much uncertainty and new challenges.
You know, the next few weeks, it's anybody's guess as to how this will all play out. But the good news is the Constitution is really clear on what needs to take place. We have a vote, they recount the vote, they certify the vote, and then the Electoral College kicks into place, and those who are selected make their vote based on their state's ballots. And then we have inauguration time. So I think that is going to flow, whether it's President Trump or Vice President Biden, the process will play out. And I think we as Christians particularly need to support the outcome once it's validated. And I hope that will be the case. And certainly pray. You know what? Salvation is not going to be found in human beings. It's found in Jesus Christ and Him alone. So the gospel is the key, and we've got to continue to remember how do we express the gospel in a culture that sometimes is friendly and sometimes is hostile. And I think if you were to pray tonight, the Lord's going to give you assurance that He has dealt with both friendly and hostile environments. So I think we've got to press forward and do what we need to do in our communities and in this nation to express the gospel of Jesus Christ. You know, I think my initial response to the election results as we know them so far was disappointment in that those things that we care passionately about, whether it's the preborn baby, euthanasia, the nuclear family, and the importance of the family and the culture and the need to strengthen it. Those are the things we concentrate on each and every day. And it just felt like slightly too few Americans realize the importance of those areas. And so, yeah, I'd say a bit of a disappointment, at least right now. But we're going to keep fighting on those things that we believe in because we believe those are the areas that will help this culture build itself into something even better and greater than we are today. I think it all starts and ends with the family. And for those that want to deconstruct the nuclear family, I think you're going right after the very pillars that make our nation so strong. We have to battle through this. We have to do the things that the Lord has called us to do. And if you see it, I mean, it's the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, goodness, kindness, mercy. That's what we need to be about. Even in the heat of political battles. So it's a tough battle, but the Lord has equipped us to carry it out. So we need to love our neighbor and still stand firmly on those principles that we believe in. And I think He'll give us the ability, the wisdom, the courage to do it.
We need to stand for truth. We need to be faithful to what God has called us to do, and we need to do so while loving our neighbor. You know, every year around this time, around Thanksgiving, we are reminded of and think back upon the pilgrims and the story behind the first Thanksgiving. And this year, 2020, actually marks the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower at Plymouth Rock and the signing of the Mayflower Compact, which was America's first great governmental document. And it was signed in 1620 by the members of the Pilgrims, as well as members who were aboard the Mayflower who didn't identify with the Pilgrims, but came to the New World for other reasons. And the Pilgrims, of course, the separatists from the Church of England, they came for freedom. And we need to remember that. And the bedrock, the foundation that they established in the New World for religious freedom and self-governance. And in 1620, they came together to sign this document before disembarking from their ship. After spending 66 days at sea, including sailing through treacherous storms, the Mayflower finally reached America. The Pilgrims had initially intended to settle in the northern parts of the existing Virginia colony and had tried to reach the region, but fierce winds blew them much further north to a region completely outside of Virginia's jurisdiction. They finally put ashore at Cape Cod in what is now the Massachusetts area, and they found an empty and uninhabited location in which to settle. And when the Pilgrims came ashore, they fell to their knees and thanked God, reaffirming their continuing reliance upon Him and His providence in bringing the biblically based principles that became the seeds of the greatest and freest nation the world has ever known. The Mayflower Compact clearly stated what they had undertaken was for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith. And, you know, it seems like with each passing year, those on the progressive left and secular forces try harder and harder each year to try to undermine the story of the Pilgrims and the Mayflower and the Mayflower Compact and make them out to be these evil villains and caricatures and people in a story that should be forgotten. And this, of course, isn't true. It needs to be remembered, perhaps more than ever before, because the core members of the Pilgrims immigrant group were separatists, members of a Puritan sect that had split from the Church of England, and they were religious refugees. They were fleeing severe persecution, and they had others in the group who were not separatists at all or not religious at all, and yet they came together as a group of citizens who would be governed by, quote, just and equal laws, ordinances, acts, constitutions, and offices, as shall be thought most convenient for the general good of the colony, under which we promise all due submission and obedience. In 1802, John Quincy Adams described the Mayflower Compact as, quote, the only instance in human history of that positive original social compact. And, of course, it is also popularly believed to have influenced the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution, which again gave birth to the freest and most prosperous nation in the history of the world. And this is where it all started in 1620 with the Pilgrims arriving on the Mayflower at Plymouth Rock. They gave us the first ever civil governing document written in America, and it was established on Judeo-Christian values and a foundation that changed the course of history. It laid the foundation for America's commitment to government by consent of the governed. For the 102 men and women who traveled from Europe on the Mayflower, it looked like what they had set out to do was impossible, and what they had encountered upon landing in America was a nightmare. They faced certain death, and in fact, during the first winter, half perished, and certainly without help from the area's native people, probably none of them would have survived at all. But they remained firm in their faith and what they had set out to do, and they decided that their freedom and their security would not depend upon an all-powerful government or a king or a monarch. It would depend on their own ability to govern themselves, to submit to laws that they themselves had written. And with the signing of the Mayflower Compact, they broke ranks with English political theory and practice, in which unelected monarchs issued decrees and ruled by divine right. The Pilgrims were committed to their Christian faith, and they signed their compact, quote, in the presence of God. But they weren't establishing a theocracy. They established a civil body politic that would be governed and framed by just and equal laws, laws that would apply without discrimination to every member. This, at the very beginning of the American story, one can discern the concepts of equal justice and government by consent of the governed. The progressives behind the 1619 Project have suggested that it is the year 1619 and slavery that should be viewed as the authentic date for America's founding. And yet, we should hold fast to 1776 and the true origins of America's history. And yet we need to remember that the seeds of that revolution were indeed planted in 1620, the year when a rugged group of men and women sacrificed everything they had, risked their lives, fleeing from government persecution because of their beliefs, and charted a new course to establish a civil body politic and through their ideals and beliefs written down and signed in the Mayflower Compact, served as the seeds of what would ultimately become the United States of America, the envy of freedom, opportunity, and prosperity of the world, and a beacon for religious liberty. And it is these ideals of self-governance and the right to live and work according to one's religious beliefs that we must fight to preserve in America today. That's all the time we have for this week. To learn how you can partner with Nebraska Family Alliance to defend religious liberty and advance family values, visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. I'm your host, Nate Graz, Policy Director for the Nebraska Family Alliance, hoping you'll join us again next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.